Welcome to House Mountain Radio on 91.5 WLUR-FM, and tonight we're very happy to have Mr. Hugh Blackmer on the show, retiring science librarian here at Washington Lee University in Lexington. Prior to working here, he received a degree in anthropology from Harvard University, joined the Peace Corps for 2 years, then attained a PhD at Stanford University, and taught in Nova Scotia for a number of years before coming here to join us in Lexington. Mr. Blackmer, well, few people know that he builds and plays a variety of exotic acoustic instruments, and today on the show he's brought along a couple mandocellos, a little-known cousin to the mandolin, and we'd like to hear a little. Right. Well, actually, he started off here with the guitar. I was actually too busy looking at the board and thing, which he has many instruments laying around the studio here. And I believe that was a guitar tuned to, was it open E?
It's an open E minor.
Open E minor. And well, in these open tunings, you've talked about, you've written some essays that are found online, and you talk about playing a lot of Eastern-based music and being attracted to a lot of modal kinds of music. And you have a mandocello, and I thought one of the interesting things that you wrote, that the mandocello is a great instrument for the type of improvisatory Eastern-based music because there's no rules, so few people play mandocello. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about the instrument.
Well, really, it's just kind of a giant mandolin. To make the sense out of that, you know, you think about, well, where did mandolins come from, and how do you get something like a mandocello being built? Sort of an oversized mandolin. And I don't know exactly when the first mandolin appeared, but it was probably somewhere in the 18th century, probably in Italy. But they came in families, because a mandolin is just like a violin in terms of its size and scale length and so on, except it has frets and it has double strings. So there's a mandolin, there's a mandola, which is just like a viola. So if there's a cello, there's got to be a mandocello.
Yeah, so like two octaves, tuned two octaves lower than a mandolin?
No, it's an octave and a fifth. So okay. A mandolin would be, and the mandocello is.
Okay.
So it's sort of the baritone in the range, in the plectral choir. And around the turn of the century, the turn of the 19th into the 20th century, there were mandolin orchestras all over the place. I think there was even a mandolin orchestra at W&O.
Really?
There was certainly a banjo orchestra, and I think there was a mandolin orchestra.
Yeah, I think I've seen the pictures of the banjo orchestra, somebody out there should dig up some of those, mandolin orchestra photos.
Oh, yeah, and I'm sure if there was one, there's pictures in the archives, and Von Stanley would find them for you.
Correct.
But anyway, there was a sort of vogue for about 20 years in mando orchestras playing from written music, mostly pretty corny music, and that's why the instruments got built. The important builders at that time were people like Orville Gibson. Everybody's heard about Gibson mandolins. Well, he built mandocellos and mandolas too, because there was this market. And not very many mandocellos. I don't know really how many, but it's in the small number of thousands. And there are a certain number of them still around. They're now, they're like hen's teeth. They're hard to find.
Yeah.
They're very, very expensive for the real thing.
And luckily you have one.
And luckily I have one.
What year is that?
This one's a 1920.
Wow, and it's in beautiful shape.
If it was a 1924 or 25 built during the era when Lloyd Lohr worked for Gibson, it'd be worth even more.
Like Bill Monroe's mandolin,
right? Yeah,
the famous.
So there's all this mystique about the instruments.
It's interesting because it has sort of the later, you know, the scrolled construction, but it has the, you know, The opening in the middle.
Right.
It doesn't have the F.
Yeah. Actually, there are versions that do have F holes, and, you know, it's that kind of stuff that instrument people go nuts about, all these little details about, you know, construction and stuff like that.
And if everyone can see, it's just a beautiful instrument. It's just basically, it looks like, this distance, just an oversized mandolin with almost pretty much a guitar length, scale length of the neck. And so, well, would you like to play a little mandocello for us?
The thing about all the mando family is what it does best.
Alabama Jubilee,
which is kind of a ragtime tune. And a lot of the stuff that I played at one time or another is sort of in that realm of ragtime. You know, there are bluegrass versions of it and stuff like that.
Yeah, but one thing I know we talked about before you came in the studio tonight was just the scale and, you know, the string tension on this. It's very difficult to play, you know, full chords on, you know, the mandocello. When people think of mandolins, they think the bluegrass style, but just, it, you know, the style that you have to approach it with is totally different.
Yeah, it really is. You can play chords like that. Lovely chord. Which are, you know, chords that you'd use in bluegrass easily enough, but you aren't going to be playing all that many chords that take up all four strings because very few people have hands that'll reach that far.
Oh, yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing. And we talked about some of the, just when you were younger, with the music you were first interested in, was a lot of like Armenian Greek music, what, for lack of a better term, what people call ethnic music, but it's just ethnic to us.
Yep.
And you think about it, and it seems like this instrument's so well suited.
Oh, well, yes. But I suppose any instrument can do all kinds of
things.
That's
true. Probably just as easily pull out a Skip James tune and somehow. And,
probably,
you know.
Although the Skip James tunes that I play are guitar things, but yeah.
Okay, great.
Certainly blues, and there's all kinds of wonderful blues possibilities with the mandocello that, well.
Who knew? Until tonight. That's interesting. Maybe we could just talk a little bit. I know you've collaborated for several years with a Nova Scotian guitarist, Danielle Aigolo.
Danielle Aigolo, yes. He's one of those people, he's one of the guitar gods, only mostly people don't know that. Mm-hmm. He's just an astonishing musician, and I've known him for a little more than 20 years. We've been playing together all that time. He lives in my house in Nova Scotia, so I'm a patron of the arts because he's an impecunious musician. And I go up there 1 week out of every year, and basically we turn on the recorder and leave it on. And most of what we play is improvised, as opposed to things where there's some kind of plot or plan ahead of time. Sometimes there is. Sometimes it's a known tune. More likely, it's just something that just happens. Mm-hmm. And if the recorder's on, you capture it. And if the recorder isn't on, it goes into the wherever tunes go.
And do you discuss it beforehand, saying we might start with this and that scale?
Very rarely.
Or it just kind of falls into place?
It just falls into place. And actually, maybe that Clytemnestra's Wobble might be a good example. I mean, it's pretty weird, but still, mm-hmm. it's a good example. This is one of those things. Every one of these things has a story behind it. And this one, it was the first coffee of the day.
Right? Uh-huh.
So there was the coffee, and I picked up this. It's an instrument I built. It's like a saz. It has an infinitely long neck. Basically, it started out, I was trying to make the longest necked instrument I could that was still playable. And that's why the instrument got built in the first place. And so I picked that up, and I just happened to hit a chord that sounded really interesting.
Yeah.
Never played it before, never planned to. And Danielle picked up the mandocello and a slide, and he answered that chord. And it sounded so good. I said, well, let's turn on the recorder.
Let's just go.
And
yeah.
So we did. And if you got, and afterwards it got a name.
Okay.
It got named Clytemnestra's Wobble,
okay.
Which doesn't mean anything. A wobble is a kind of a tune, a sort of a ragtimey sort of a thing. 1920s, 1930s tunes are sometimes called wobbles. And because it sounds Middle Eastern, we called it Clytemnestra's Wobble.
Sounds good.
So that's number two, I think.
Do you want to play that now?
Sure.
Okay.
May as well.
It's the second track on the CD, so. Thank you. Okay, on House Mountain Radio, 91.5 WLUR-FM, presenting the best in live acoustic music from Rockbridge County. And we're just listening to a little bit of Hugh Blackmer's collaboration with Nova Scotian guitarist Daniele Colo. And we have Mr. Blackmer in the studio with us today. And we were just talking a little bit why that song played about instrument building and featured on that last track was sort of a homemade says, for lack of a better term. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about your ethic towards instrument building and how that's kind of shaped your musical experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, I started building instruments about 1980, and there's no point in building guitars because you can buy better guitars than you can build. And so it's much more interesting to build instruments that either don't exist yet or there's something weird about them one way or another, and you know, try and figure out, well, how do you build a particular sound? And sometimes it's a matter of, I want a sound that's just like this thing I heard on a CD. Sometimes it's a matter of, here's some materials, what can I do with them? And in the case of that saz, it has an enormously long neck, and I thought, okay, I want to build something that is as long a neck as you can possibly reach to play and see what happens when you have a really long doubled string or tripled string, as it is in that case. So it has a fairly small kind of mandolin-shaped body with this huge long neck and some really fat strings, so it has a real nice bass to it. But it's also got some real thin strings in there. So nobody can tell me how to play it. I mean, it's mine to play.
It's all over the place.
Because, you have to make it up. Mm-hmm. And that's the fun of doing things.
Now,
like
how many
that.
Strings does that have on it?
That one has 8 strings. There's 3, 3, and 2.
Okay.
And each trio of strings, you got 2 that are in unison and one of them that's either a 4th or a 5th away from that, depending upon how I choose to tune it. And so it's in some very weird tuning, which is full of all these kind of jangly notes that are related
so
to
it. Did you think about modifying a traditional saz for that, or was it more sort of the creation of
the saz? The only reason it's called a saz is because it looks more like a saz than it looks like anything else.
Okay.
And sazes don't have frets. They have little ligatures that are tied around the neck, and so they're not stuck to the tempered scale like a guitar is or a mandolin is.
Speaking of instruments, I see you brought out a different mandocello.
This is a different mandocello. Yeah, this one is the maker's Dell'Arte. Mm-hmm. And it's a flat top as opposed to a carved top. All the Gibson ones are carved top for various technical reasons. In this case, this is built on a body designed after the Selmer jazz guitars that are famous mostly for Django Reinhardt,
yes,
and so on, gypsy guitars. And so this has an 8-string neck on it. And it, other than that, it's very, what shall I say, considerable fidelity to the way those things are built, and it has just an absolutely incredible voice. In this case, it's tuned because I can't get a fat enough string for the bottom without going to frets. I'm tuning it differently. It's a minor third above a mandocello, although it started out life as a mandocello. Anyway, it has just an astonishing presence.
It sounds like just listening to it, you know, the sonic possibilities, just looking at it, are different from, you know, people think of the mandolin, you can just bend the notes so much more easily.
Yeah.
I mean, the frets are spaced differently, so you can really reach out in a lot of those higher positions that are just aren't possible on the mandolin.
Right. Yeah.
Wow.
So there are chord possibilities with it. Thank you.
it sounds similar just looking at it. I know you also play bouzouki. Is that how you
mm-hmm,
pronounce
yeah.
it?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and it seems in some ways it's a similar instrument as far as scale and, you know.
Yeah, the bouzouki is a smaller body, so it doesn't mm-hmm. have that enormous resonance to it that this has. And has a longer, tighter neck, and but that whole kind of... That's very kind of bouzouki-like. Yeah,
yes.
Right.
You said you also had an interest in a lot of Celtic music, you know, Irish music, mm-hmm. and the mandocello also lends itself to that type of music? Or
it does.
Challenge?
That one of the things that came along somewhere in about the mid-1970s, there was suddenly a revival in Celtic music. And I have a whole lot of silly theories about why that happened then and why it happened to the people it happened to, which I won't bore you with at the moment. But in any case, there were a bunch of people who took traditional Irish music and put it onto new instruments that weren't in the tradition, guitar being one case
exactly.
in point.
Yes.
But also, there's a guy named Johnny Moynihan who went to Greece and came back with a bouzouki and started playing Irish music and other kinds of stuff too, but Irish music on the bouzouki. And that led to the development, well, it led to a lot of people wanting to make that sound, and it led to the development of something called the Irish bouzouki, which is a flat-backed, not unlike the mandocello in terms of its voice and so on, tends to be not tuned in the cello-y sort of way. It usually is tuned in something that's much easier to make chords on. Anyway, it got to be a really common accompaniment instrument in some corners of Irish music. So there's this explosion in the late 1970s of bands playing traditional material but with a completely different kind of arrangements and instrumentation.
And it's interesting because
amazing.
A lot of people, you know, my age or sort of that generation almost think of a bouzouki as an Irish instrument now.
Yeah.
You know, you see a lot of the traditional Irish bands, and I was in Ireland all spring, and you know, you can see a lot of that.
Maybe I'll play an Irish tune.
Excellent. Great segue. Talking a lot about Eastern-based music and, you know, the different modes and that, but also there's a lot of similarities when you talk about, you know, Anglo-Celtic music and you talk about modes, or first it sounds foreign, but when you think about, say, the mountain dulcimer or something, think about an instrument that's tuned, you know, in that modal fashion. And we were talking earlier about when people think of more Western music that's also sort of in that tradition, when you think about, you know, Doc Boggs, the banjo player from Southwest Virginia, or perhaps John Fahey with his open tuning finger picking. So it you know, definitely exists in the Western tradition, but we don't immediately think of that.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
And there are some very strange modes that, well, the standard thing, like Ionian mode and Dorian mode, that's major and minor scale, basically. But there are some other ones like West Virginia. There aren't that many tunes in the sort of American folk music canon that are in the Phrygian mode, but it's a wonderful mode to jam in.
Well, that sounds excellent. Now, when you're talking about, we talked about your collaboration a little bit with Danielle up in Nova Scotia, and does he sort of come from that same background of being interested in more of ethnic music, esoteric music, that where you all met on a common ground, or do you feel like you bring in different influences into your collaborations?
He's one of those people who, he has really big ears, meaning, I don't mean physically, I mean metaphorically really big ears. He's listened to a whole lot of different kinds of things, and he loves listening to variety. And I've been collecting variety for a long time, so we had an enormous amount to share. And on top of that, he's an incredible player, so he could listen to something and then start to play something that fit with it. So we've been trading stuff back and forth like that, and he knows a whole lot more, for instance, about jazz than I do, and some of the weird corners of jazz, and I know a whole lot more about Turkish music than he does, the weird corners of Turkish music. And you put those things together, and you got something that burns with a real blue flame, you know.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And it sounds like, you know, just growing up in a lot of places you frequented, just a hotbed for these different forms of music. You spent a lot of time in Cambridge, I believe in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It was probably an exciting time to discover this new music.
Oh, yeah.
I think you wrote in an essay that it was a way to escape the typical blah California teenagerhood.
Yeah, well, I never did typical blah. It was, I mean, I've always, I think, sought out things that were more exotic and, you know, enjoyed knowing stuff that other people didn't know. So that's how you end up being a librarian. you're interested in weird stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very interesting. And back then it was a little more difficult to find these records. I think you had to frequent a lot of mail order houses and
Right. And in fact, well, you know, some people say, oh, you know, for some reason there's not nearly that much variety of music. Well, there is. There's a wider variety now than ever before.
Mm-hmm.
And more influences that are sort of colliding with each other. And the MP3 medium on the web is just a real revelation in terms of accessibility of a whole lot of different kinds of music. And free music in the sense not just of not being from record companies that have digital rights management on them, but free in the sense of taking off in directions that nobody took off in before. And there's a public. People will find it, people will listen to it, people will collect it. It's really an exciting time.
Thank God for the internet.
Yeah, there you go.
That's right. Would you like to play a little more for us, or perhaps play a little off the CD? Or
why don't you play something off the CD?
Okay.
Maybe the first one, just because it's a nice example of the kinds of stuff Danielle and I have done.
Yeah, it's a nice
Middle
Eastern cello
sense. Yeah.
Guitar duet. So.
Yeah. Thank you.
back to House Mound Radio, 91.5 WLUR-FM, bringing you the best in live acoustic music from Rockbridge County. And today we have Mr. Hugh Blackmorin with us playing his mandocello. And also in the coming weeks, on September 2nd, we have Bluegrass Trail coming in the studio. September 8th, High Ground. I believe September 22nd, Andy and Tony Williams playing some old-time music with us. And lots of good music lined up in the coming weeks, so check out our website at wlur.wlu.edu for coming shows. And also we have past shows archived with Mike Seeger, Monrovia, the Deer Creek Boys, and lots of great music on there. Like I said, we're in the studio with Mr. Hugh Blackmorin with a beautiful instrument today, the mandocello. Totally underrated. And we talked a little bit about, you just heard a collaboration with Nova Scotian guitarist Daniel Kahlo called Freak Out at the Souvlaki Hangout, and a very interesting track. I was just wondering, you talked about recording this up in Nova Scotia. In the studio, do you both play around a live acoustic mic, or how does that sort of engineer when you're playing these very close improvisatory duets?
Usually it's just sometimes more than two microphones, because Danielle has a home studio that's pretty elaborate and very high-end, direct-to-digital, and so forth. So, and he knows what he's doing with mic placement and all that kind of stuff. So it's just in one of the rooms of the house, and he unplugs the phone, mm-hmm. and we just play. And who knows what's going to happen? Some of it's garbage, you know, we throw it away. or some of it turns out not to be garbage once you do the EQ on it and all kinds of other stuff
Dust
that I barely understand. Yeah, right, yeah. Anyway, that's where it happens. It's just in his house.
And it's interesting you've really kept up your collaboration, since I don't think you've lived in Nova Scotia for going on probably 17 or 18 years.
Well, it's about 15, but yeah.
15.
Something like that, yeah.
But you still travel up there every once
in a while.
We go
up there, since we still have the house up there that Daniel lives in, we go for about a week every summer. And basically what we do is just play a lot during that time and mm-hmm. record as much of it as there's space to record or fingers that can stand it and stuff like that. And sometimes it kind of depends on his mood, too. Sometimes he just doesn't feel like playing much. So you know, we don't play.
It sounds like a great vacation, though.
Oh, yeah.
Working vacation.
Wonderful. Yeah.
Now, you said we talked a little bit about what you just mentioned over the break, that you taught sort of a cross-cultural approach to music in courses here in Nova Scotia. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. When I was teaching at Acadia University in Nova Scotia, I'm an anthropologist by background. So the thing about being an anthropologist is you can do anything and get away with it, because nobody can tell you that that's not anthropology, because nobody
exactly.
knows, which is a lot of fun. And it's quite clear that music is a human universal. Everybody does it. And musicians are found in all cultures. They play different things. They do different, but there's that subset of people who are musicians, which is a fascinating thing. You know, it's culture. It's a kind of, or an aspect of culture. And it's perfectly sensible to study it, and you shouldn't just leave it to musicologists. Why not study it as cultural artifact of one kind or another? And that's one of the things that I've done as an anthropologist, to say, okay, hey, I'm interested in music. I'll do ethnomusicology, but I'm not doing it from a musicology point of view nearly so much as I am from the point of view of trying to get some way to have students appreciate a little more about variety in humanity. And music is a wonderful way, because you can hear it, and you can train yourself with experience to understand and appreciate music that has some very basically different structure from that you grew up with. You can grow bigger ears, so to speak. So back around 1980 or so, I started co-teaching a course with a guy in the School of Music at Acadia on world music, only that's an awful term. I don't like to use that term.
Like ethnic music.
ethnic music, that's okay, except that, you know, it's kind of mystifying it a bit. So we called it cross-cultural studies in music. And my wife always said it was just an excuse to buy more records. And she was right. I mean, I used it as an excuse to buy more records, and I have an unspeakable number of I can't tell you how many because I don't know. It's not seemly to count them. But anyway, and so I collected a lot of stuff, and you know, I'd follow particular lines and stuff like that, and I'd bring them in and I'd play them and try to come to some kind of an understanding about what it was we were listening to. So I had a music professor who could take stuff apart from a music theory point of view and talk about it, and me who could give the background to what this was we were hearing. So every year, we taught it for 7 years, and every year it had a different array of recordings, and we knew more stuff, and we had more things to say, and we talked faster, and we played the music faster, and you know, by the last year, it was just kind of totally out of control. But it was so much fun. It was just, you know, it was really creative. The School of Music to which he belonged refused to give him credit for teaching it because I was not competent to teach music from their point of view.
Really?
Which, yeah. People have silly ideas about all kinds of things, especially in the academic world. Anyway, and I kept this interest after I left being a college professor in anthropology in Nova Scotia and went to library school. Of course, I kept my musical instruments for sure and interests and kept working on things. And then, this being my last year at WNL, I thought, well, okay, it's time to dust this stuff off again, get it out again, and think about it again. And I've been teaching courses for university scholars for 5 or 6 years, different sorts of courses. And Greg Cooper, who's in charge of university scholars, had been after me to teach what he called the ethnomusicology course. So I did, but I decided that the important thing was to look at it as 21st century ethnomusicology and try to figure out about what's going on now with MP3s and mashups and all kinds of other stuff like that. So we had a really great time. I did buy more records, more CDs. In fact, I bought a lot more. But I also found a lot of stuff out there on the web. So there are web pages. There's a whole suite of web pages in my WNL web page stuff from that course. And unfortunately, some of the music isn't there because, you know, I could use it as fair use in the class, but I can't really put it out there for people to download because, you know, it's just not how you do those things.
So are there any particular forms of music that you're enamored with now and sort of incorporating?
Well, I've been interested especially in Middle Eastern music of various kinds and in Greek music for a very long time. But there are lots of others that I've spent time kind of into one time or another. A lot of Scandinavian music, a lot of Hungarian music at various times. And both of those have had the kind of revival that happened with Irish music, where suddenly young people saw that there was a whole lot in the folk music heritage, if only you kind of spun it about 45 degrees and gave it a shove with electricity or, you know, various kinds of things like that. So there are these new Scandinavian musics that are emerging that are just really exciting stuff, and some of them have the old lyrics, the old medieval murder ballad lyrics and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
But they're done in this incredibly driving, powerful way with electric hurdy-gurdies and stuff like that.
Nickel harpa.
Yeah, nickel harpa, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's an amazing instrument.
Astonishing instrument. And to see somebody who really knows how to play it, it's a revelation, you know. It's like, oh, so that's how they get that sound, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So do you think you'd play a little more mandocello for us?
Sure, let's see. The question is, what to play?
Whatever you want.
Whatever I want. I think maybe what I'll try and do is a little bit of a little bit of improvising in the sense that I don't know exactly what I'm going to do. But this, Danielle has a tune called Ding Dong Woo, where it has this figure repeated again and again in all kinds of settings. So I think what I'll try and do is start off with that and see if I can find something to make up out of it, because that's one of the main things I do is thank you.
Well, it sounds excellent. And it's interesting, it's very percussive, rhythmic music. And you really realize it in some of the recordings that you did with Danielle that have the frame drum and the different percussion instruments. And you also play with a lot of drums and different things as well.
I don't play the drums.
You don't.
No, no.
But
that's all Danielle.
That's all him.
Yeah.
It definitely adds a different flavor to that music. And especially with a lot of forms that people don't think. A lot of, we said we don't like the term world music, but a lot of world music, where some cultures, they think of being very polyrhythmic and using the drums and others, which, totally sort of ignore the percussive elements, but you all sort of throw it all into the mixture and bring a lot of nice forms in there, especially with the use of recorders. Are there any other tracks you'd like to play off that? Or
sure.
Playing, or?
Let's see, I don't have the set list.
I have it with
right
me.
There.
I liked Appalachia.
Okay,
that's
an interesting one. Actually, that's the tune I started out with
okay.
at the very beginning. But hey, play it because what it does is show. You start out with something that's a figure that I had because of a characteristic of that tuning, but then Danielle puts this whole other construction on it and takes it to just a really interesting place. So it's a nice example of the kind of thing that happens in improvisation.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you.
House Mountain Radio, 91.5 WLUR-FM, and we're just in the studio tonight with Mr. Hugh Blackmer playing mandocello, and a man who builds and performs on a variety of different exotic acoustic instruments. And we want to thank you very much for coming in tonight.
My pleasure.
I just have one question. What is your favorite instrument?
Oh, favorite.
I know there's many.
Oh, it comes and goes. The most magnificent one is the Gibson mandocello. I mean, it's one of the great mandocellos. That's all there is to it. And but it's a handful to play. So it isn't. Some weeks it's not my favorite because I haven't got the strength in my hands to play it. And then other times it's suddenly the favorite again. I'm really fickle about favorites. Mm-hmm. So I can't answer that question.
Yeah. Well, tonight's your night to advocate this fine instrument. More people should buy it.
Oh, yeah.
Are people actually making
mandocellos? Oh, yes. There are really good makers. Basically, the problem is that there aren't enough of them for there to be factories that turn them out. So they do tend to be produced one at a time or something like that. Ovation makes a really nice one out of basically space-age materials, which has electronics in it, so you can plug it in. Mm-hmm. I have one of those.
You have one, yes.
Oh, it's a monster. It's just wonderful. Mm-hmm. But you know, the basic price for that is probably $1,500 or something like that. And if you want the best, you're probably going to commission one for $20,000, and you're probably going to wait 5 years for it. Or at least the last time I knew about the guy who's the best builder, that was the price, and that was how long you had to wait. That's ridiculous. But that's kind of the way it is.
So there's no revival of the mandolin orchestra?
No, I don't think there are mandolin orchestras. There are a bunch of them around. There's one in Nashville that's just wonderful.
Oh, really?
And, you know, there are all kinds of people who do that kind of thing, but it's kind of a... That's not their day job. It's just something they do on the side. Mandocello, though, is showing up in all kinds of stuff. Sometimes electric, sometimes not. It's some really innovative players.
And I know we discussed this at one point. A lot of people tune in the show to listen to bluegrass on several old Jim and Jesse McReynolds records. Believe it or not, it's mandocello on there. A lot of people talk about his mandolin cross-picking style, and several of those records are mandocello. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, there's also a mando bass out there.
There is, and it is the ugliest thing you ever did see.
Oh, I'm sure it's monstrous. Few men can control it.
Right, exactly.
Well, we want to thank you very much for coming in and sharing your music and your knowledge with us tonight. I think we wanted to sign off with a particular unnamed tune, and it's a duet with mandocello bass recorder.
Bass recorder, which is not exactly an everyday instrument either. Again, it's Danielle playing the bass recorder, and he plays it with a method and style that is utterly, totally his own.
Bring it in the room with the mando bass, they'll fight it out.
Right, yeah.
Okay, well, thank you all very much for listening. Thank you.
Thank you.